Hello, friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Thursday, February 25th, 2021. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Here's our first story. Comes to us from the Des Moines Register. Disturbing incidents and trends cited by the Iowa Regents who agree to new policies to create penalties for free speech violations. Following controversies over free speech this fall, the state's Board of Regents voted to approve policies Wednesday aimed at bolstering free discussion on college campuses, including penalties for free speech violations and restrictions on public policy positions by college leaderships. Since the onset of the school year, an Iowa State University professor barred arguments that oppose topics like Black Lives Matter and gay rights, and a conservative student group tweeted that people should arm up after Joe Biden won the presidency. University of Northern Iowa student government leaders presented an anti-abortion student group, an anti-abortion student group from forming, saying that it would create a hostile environment on campus. And questions swirled at the University of Iowa after a College of Dentistry summoned a student to a disciplinary hearing for publicly supporting a Trump executive order. Questions about how to handle each incident or such incidents and the climate that similar events created on a college campus prompted Board of Regents President Michael Richards to create a committee that was charged with analyzing the condition of free speech at the three universities in November. The Board of Regents and our universities absolutely support free speech and open dialogue. Every faculty, staff, and student must feel confident that their constitutional rights are protected on our campuses and that they will not face retribution for exercising their rights. That, Richards said at a Wednesday meeting. We must be honest and recognize that there have been several recent incidents when this expectation has not been met. On Wednesday, the Regents unanimously approved 10 recommendations made by the Board's Free Speech Committee, which currently consists of Regents David Baker, Nancy Bodiger, and Zach Liest. The committee will remain a permanent fixture of the Regents and be responsible for handling free speech complaints, reviewing policies, conducting surveys and research, and ensuring that the universities provide yearly training on free speech. Regents are planning to incorporate the full set of recommendations into current Board of Regent policy and present the final language for approval in April. The universities will also be expected to add policies and procedures, including penalties for violations of free expression, to current policy language. The Regents did not elaborate on what those penalties might entail at their meeting. Members of college leadership will also be barred from taking institutional positions on policies unless it is in conjunction with the Board of Regents. When the university itself or its departments and administrators take stands on social issues, individuals are discouraged from thinking for themselves, and the mission of the university is compromised. That according to Baker on Wednesday. The Free Speech Committee, he said, was created to consider policy changes to counter what we see as disturbing incidents and trends that threaten freedom of expression and freedom of academic inquiry. Earlier this month, the Republican-led House Government Oversight Committee summoned representatives from three Regents universities to testify about free speech issues on their campuses. In August, an Iowa State professor's syllabus said students could not choose any topic that takes as its base the one side doesn't deserve some basic human rights as you do. In other words, no arguments against gay marriage, no arguments against abortion, no arguments against Black Lives Matter. The university took corrective action against that professor after the stance came to light. We very quickly moved from this, again, disappointing, egregious action by one faculty member. We addressed that situation and now have put into place a system-wide approach to prevent that from happening in the future. That according to President Wendy Winterstein, she mentioned or talked about that with respect to an incident at the February 2 legislative hearing. The recommendation by the region's Free Speech Committee requires syllabi to include a statement in support of free speech, a measure Iowa State has already implemented. The statement is expected to be reviewed at the beginning of each course. Regents also voted to approve policy language that would prohibit members of the university leadership, including presidents, vice presidents, deans, and department directors, from taking institutional positions on policies unless the statement is made alongside the regents. It is not uncommon for university leadership to take policy positions, and University of Iowa President Bruce Harrod and other top administrators, as well as 29 members of the College of Dentistry, publicly condemned an executive order by the Trump administration just last fall. The order prohibited universities and other public institutions from holding certain diversity trainings that it said suggested individuals can unconsciously hold racist or sexist thoughts. Critics of that order said it clamped down on diversity efforts that challenge systemic racism, and in December, a federal judge in California issued a preliminary nationwide injunction against it. We are deeply disappointed in both the intention behind and the language used in the executive order, which carries the force of law, Harrod wrote in a campus-wide statement at that time. Leadership of the dentistry school, included the dean, sent an email in October to the entire college condemning the order. Many students and faculty replied. One student, Michael Braes, said that he thought the university should support the executive order and asked for further clarification about the dental school's position on it. College leadership then summoned Braes to a disciplinary hearing for unprofessional conduct related to the exchange of emails. But the hearing never happened because Braes contacted state legislatures with concerns about his right to freedom of speech being violated. The dentistry college's dean, David Johnson, apologized to members of the House Government Oversight Committee earlier this month about the incident, both for his public condemnation of the executive order, and for the college's initial decision to summon Braes to a hearing. Under the committee's recommendation, the universities would also be prohibited from permitting discrimination or denial of educational benefits because of a student or organization's viewpoint. In October, student government leaders at the University of Northern Iowa denied a student request to form a local chapter of Students for Life of America, a national nonprofit that opposes abortion, arguing that the group would create a hostile environment on campus. University President Mark Nook eventually overturned the student government's decision, citing students' free speech rights. I hope that the recommendation that we have are well received. The recommendations that we have are well received, and actions are taken on them to prevent any further incidents. That, according to Regent Leist, speaking about the policies voted on at Wednesday's meet. However, she continued, I do know with our recommendations, we will never completely eliminate freedom of expression issues because, after all, we all have the right to not agree with each other. The full recommendations are written here. I'm not going to cover all of those. If you would like me to, call the IRIS office and I will be happy to do so. Our next story comes to us from Daniel Gare. Council votes to move forward with Reinvestment District Citizen Climate Action Plan Task Force. The Ames City Council voted unanimously on Tuesday to move forward with the Reinvestment District pre-application that could fund a new municipal pool and bring more development downtown. City officials presented the pre-application for the Reinvestment District, the state program that could give new life to building an aquatic center. The current municipal pool is set for demolition in 2022. The pool has all the elements people wanted before, City Manager Stephen Shanker said. With all the development you see coming on, we're going to draw a lot of people downtown. The city set a fundraising goal of $8 million to help fund the aquatic center. The aquatic center project will cost $27 million, and will be funded primarily through general obligation bonds, as the rebate will not be paid up front. Shanker said development along Lincoln Way, which will include a new hotel and retail space, will generate most of the rebate, but the district will also include plans for a downtown plaza and the aquatic center. Councilmember Gloria Betcher said if submitting the application was a commitment to any of the plans included in the district, she asked that question. Shanker said there is no commitment with the pre-application. If the city wants to include a new development in the district in the future, staff can request an amendment to the district, Shanker said. This will not increase the allotment from the state, but it will help the city pay off their debt faster, he said. You will not win if you do not play, Betcher said. If we don't put this forward, we could lose millions of dollars from the state that could help fund a project. On the agenda Tuesday were two items that involved avenues for community input. The council discussed representation on a community input task force on the development of a climate action plan. In an April 2020 waste recovery report, the result was a recommendation for a city climate action plan after a year of calls from environmental groups for a plan. At a December meeting, the council requested city staff to draft a proposal for the task force to receive more community input. A document lays out the representation on the 22-member task force, which will include 3 business representatives, 2 faith-based organizations, an Iowa State student government representative, among other community members and stakeholders. Councilmember Rachel Junk, an Iowa State senator, recommended more student representation on the task force. Assistant City Manager Deb Shadroth said there would also be an educational element, as many do not know how climate change and the city's action plan could impact them. We will try to make every effort possible to help people feel comfortable in participating and that they are being heard, according to Assistant City Manager Deb Shadroth. There are people coming in on this topic at varying levels, and some people may not be paying attention to this until they realize or understand that it could have an impact. Councilmember Tim Garten suggested reaching out to University President Wendy Winterstein for her input on who should represent Iowa State facilities, planning, and management, and increasing the recommended representation. I guess I would like to have some direction to Iowa State, Garten said. We might think about as well that we do not have any ability to govern what Iowa State does. My hope is that what Iowa State does would be done in concert with what we are doing. Once the city is ready to receive applicants, people will be able to apply online. City spokeswoman Susan Guinsada went to council Tuesday to ask for feedback on the upcoming resident satisfaction survey. The survey asked residents to rate their satisfaction in several city departments, including Parks and Recreation, Ames Public Library, Police and Fire Departments, and Street Maintenance. The survey will be sent in April to 150 random city utility customers, and they are due back by May. The city collaborates with Iowa State to develop a report each year based on the responses. Guisada presents the results to the council in October, which could influence their goals and decisions. The council voted unanimously to move forward with the survey. Our next story comes to us from Philip Sitter. Iowa State's bridge project near Jack Trice Stadium gets final approval for expected summer start to construction. The Iowa Board of Regents has given final approval for a $10 million pedestrian bridge that would span the road east of Jack Trice Stadium to move forward with construction. The region's Property and Facilities Committee last week gave their approval to the proposed quarter-mile-long elevated gateway bridge that would connect the east side of the stadium at Gate 2 to new parking lots east of University Boulevard. The committee's approval left the full board to give its go-ahead, which they did on Wednesday upon approving the consent agenda for that day's meeting. The pedestrian bridge is being paid for by two donors, $5 million gifts each last fall, and is viewed by Iowa State's athletics department as critical to future development around the stadium. The Gateway Bridge would connect the stadium with a planned parking lot of 300 spaces for recreational vehicles, each with electrical hookups to be located east of University Boulevard, which connects campus directly to Highway 30. Athletic officials also have said the bridge would improve pedestrians' ability to cross University Boulevard on Cyclone football game days. As for a timeline on construction, Pam Kane, Iowa State Senior Vice President for Operations and Finance, told the Facilities Committee last week, quote, "The construction bids are expected in early summer 2021, with construction to begin during the summer of 2021, with an anticipated completion date of early fall 2022. Chris Jorgensen, Iowa State Senior Associate Athletics Director for Operations, did not have more details Wednesday to add to that timeline. The university will need an easement to build the bridge over University Boulevard's right-of-way, and they are working with the City of Ames on that easement. Our next story comes to us from Danielle Gehr. 25 new COVID-19 cases reported in Story County between Tuesday and Wednesday. An additional 25 new COVID-19 cases were confirmed in Story County from Tuesday to Wednesday, according to the state's coronavirus website on Wednesday. No new deaths were reported. At that time, state officials reported 9,455 positive cases in Story County, up from Tuesday's total of 9,430. To date, a total of 45 Story County residents have died as the result of COVID-19, according to the state website. Of those who have tested positive for the virus in Story County, 8,862 individuals have recovered, according to the state. The 14-day average positivity rate is 3.8%, down from 4.3% on Tuesday. Across Iowa, an additional 723 positive cases and 15 deaths were reported on Wednesday morning. At 10 a.m. Wednesday, the state was reporting that there are 134,106 confirmed cases of coronavirus in the state of Iowa, an increase of 723 since Tuesday. The state reported 5,415 total COVID-19 deaths across the state of Iowa, an increase of 15 since Tuesday. Total number of people tested, 1,546,449. Total number of people tested who have recovered, 311,676. Sarah Jordan Heinz contributes our next article. It's the best job ever, that's said by a Gilbert kindergarten teacher who was named a finalist for a presidential award. Angie Bonthuis, I'm going to spell her last name, B-O-N-T-H-U-I-S, perhaps it's Bonthuis, has a passion for teaching young learners, a work ethic that has not gone unnoticed by her peers and student families. Bonthuis has been named a finalist for the Presidential Award for Excellence in Mathematics and Science Teaching. She's taught kindergarten at Gilbert Elementary School for the last 21 years. Previously, she taught preschool at Southeast Webster Community Schools in Dayton, Iowa. A native of Coon Rapids, she and her family relocated to Waverly during her senior year of high school. Our neighbor was a preschool teacher, and she got me into that, Bonthuis said of her career pathway. She then attended Iowa State University, earning a degree in teaching pre-kindergarten, kindergarten children, the prior name for an early childhood education degree. She also has a master's degree from Drake University. Her mentor, Denise Carlson, who is a professor at Iowa State, nominated her for the award. Nominees are selected based on their distinction in the classroom and dedication to improving science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, otherwise known as STEM, S-T-E-M, education. The PAEMST, P-A-E-M-S-T, award is the highest recognition that a K-12 math or science teacher can earn in the United States. Bonthuis said that she had to write a paper and do videos in the classroom to be considered for the award. She has gone above and beyond with professional development and has been a leader in our building, said Stacy Edwards, the Gilbert Elementary School principal. She takes a lot of pride in what she does, the lessons she presents, and I really feel that is special about her. Bonthus enjoys getting children enthused about math and number systems, beginning at a very young age. I do a lot of problem solving with my kids, like story problems, and personalize them, she said. This year has been tough for games, but we do a lot of games with dice and dominoes using those numbers to build number sense. She is honored alongside four other Iowa finalists in mathematics: Angie Bonifus, kindergarten, Gilbert Community School; Janet Reardon, kindergarten, Southeast Polk Community District; Angela Scheiden, first grade teacher, Ankeny Community School District. In the science category, Sarah Borzo, former sixth grade science teacher in the Waukee Community School District. She's now education and outreach coordinator for Metro Waste Authority. And Deborah Huffelin, a third grade teacher at Osage Community Schools. Winners will be announced later this year. It's the best job ever. Every day is different. No one has more love in their life than a kindergartner, Bonifus said. In her spare time, she travels the country going to conferences and giving talks about her teaching techniques. She spends most of her free time here at school, Edwards said, with a laugh. She's one of the last ones to leave. She puts in time. You can learn more at her blog. Her blog can be found at www.ilovekindergarten.com. We're turning now to the printed edition of the Ames Tribune. The first story comes to us from the Associated Press. Cocaine bust in Europe is the biggest ever. The dateline on this story is Berlin, Germany. German customs officials have found more than 17 tons of cocaine in containers that arrived in Hamburg from Paraguay, authorities said on Wednesday. Another 7.9 tons of cocaine were seized in Belgium, and a suspect was arrested in the Netherlands. The Hamburg Customs Office described the find in the German port as the biggest quantity of cocaine ever seized in Europe and one of the biggest single seizures worldwide. The Dutch National Prosecutor's Office, referring to the overall haul, said that never before has so much cocaine been intercepted in a single operation. The drugs were found in a search on February 12 of five containers from Paraguay that had been flagged as suspect in a risk analysis by several European customs authorities, that according to the Hamburg office. Customs officers found the cocaine hidden in more than 1,700 cans. The freight document linked to the shipment was addressed to a 28-year-old man in the Dutch town of Vierdaagen, V-I-A-A-R-D-I-N-G-E-N, who was arrested Wednesday, according to prosecutors in the Netherlands. And here's today's Nation and World Watch. The first item from Washington: President Joe Biden's choice of Neera Tanden to lead the White House Budget Office faced new hurdles on Wednesday after two Senate committees postponed consideration of her nomination. The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee postponed a business meeting scheduled for Wednesday. The committee did not give a reason for the postponement or announce a new meeting date. The Senate Budget Committee, which also will vote on Tanden, also postponed its Wednesday meeting. From Houston, Texas, a federal judge Tuesday identified banned President Joe Biden's, a federal judge on Tuesday indefinitely banned President Joe Biden's administration from enforcing a 100-day moratorium on most deportations, that according to U.S. District Judge Drew Tipton. He issued a preliminary injunction sought by Texas, which argued the moratorium violated federal law and risked imposed additional cost on the state. Biden proposed the pause on deportations during his campaign as part of a larger review of immigration enforcement and an attempt to reverse the priorities of former President Donald Trump. Next, from Chickasaw, Oklahoma, an Oklahoma man who had been released early from prison in January as part of a mass commutation effort is now accused of 3 killings, including a death of a neighbor whose heart he cut out, according to authorities. Lawrence Paul Anderson is accused of killing Andrea Lynn Blankenship, age 41. Authorities say he brought the heart to his aunt and uncle's house. He cooked it with potatoes and tried to serve it to them before killing Leon Pyle, age 67, wounding the aunt, and killing the pair's 4-year-old granddaughter. Maiduguri, Nigeria is where our next story comes from. At least 10 people were killed and about 60 others injured in an attack by suspected jihadist rebels on the northern Nigerian city of Maiduguri, that according to officials on Wednesday. The attack started about 5:45 p.m. Tuesday when deafening sounds of explosions and the crackling of shootings by assault rifles could be heard across the city, that according to residents of Maiduguri, the provincial capital of Nigeria's northeastern Borno state, with a population of about 800,000. The outbreak lasted for hours, according to residents. Next, we have an opinion piece. It is written by Dr. Brian Klausner. He is the medical director of Wake Medical Community Population Health and chief medical officer of Wake MedKey Community Care Accountable Care. Not sure where he is located, the story doesn't say, but in any event, homeless individuals are accustomed to suffering silently. Never has this been the case than with all of the noise of the COVID-19 pandemic, in which more than 500,000 Americans have died. One wet morning this past December, as a volunteer at an emergency overnight homeless shelter in North Carolina, I had the disturbing task of closing the building in order to meet our commitment to be out by 8 o'clock that morning. This required escorting our guests outside into a freezing, pouring rain. There was a steady rain predicted for the next 3 days, with temperatures in the 40s. Cold enough to be dangerous and cause hypothermia, but not cold enough to meet the emergency shelter criteria for opening. With access to our normal local shelters restricted due to COVID-19, this meant these individuals were going to be stuck outside in the elements. As they left, most carrying large bags with their belongings through large puddles, the level of quiet acceptance and resignation was almost haunting. Most even displayed grateful smiles and expressions of gratitude as they left. Predictably, that week we saw an increase of hypothermia and exposure-related visits in our hospital. Historically, data around homelessness reveals the extent of human suffering that should push us all to action. Nationally, the life expectancy of the chronically homeless still hovers around only 50 years of age. Approximately 45% of homeless people suffer from mental illness, 25% seriously so. Demographic disparities compared with the overall population are glaring. Black individuals are overrepresented by nearly a factor of 3, compared with the general population. Too often, homeless patients are reflexive and conveniently blamed for complex societal mental health and medical pathologies that they suffer from to justify our collective inaction. This is a lazy and expensive mistake. Jim O'Connell, founder of the nation's oldest homeless healthcare program in Boston, Massachusetts, has described homelessness as a prism that highlights societal shortcomings. Refracted in vivid colors, he said, are the weaknesses in each sector, especially housing, education, welfare, labor, health, and justice. Throughout November, December, I routinely gave updates at the emergency overnight shelter around COVID-19, including plans about vaccinations. Early on, our homeless guests were relieved and honestly surprised to learn that they were being prioritized, at least in initial drafts of vaccination plans. They were not surprised to learn late in December that they had been pushed back to later stages as a part of state efforts to better align with national recommendations. While this past year has been hard for everybody, it has been absolutely a nightmare for our homeless residents. With homeless shelters and supporting programs shut down or restricted across the country, many homeless individuals have been forced to stay on the street during a cold, wet winter. National numbers are hard to come by, but a report on New York City's sheltered homeless population found their COVID-19 mortality rate to be 67% higher than the city's general population. Hospitals are seeing the disease in our homeless population. We are seeing trench foot. We are seeing hypothermia. According to analysis of nearly 190 million emergency department visits between March to October, we are also seeing increases in substance abuse, suicide, overdoses, with a 28% increase rate in opioid overdoses from that period in 2019. What is happening across homeless communities in our country is a public health crisis on top of a public health crisis. It is harming and killing a population that historically already suffers greatly as the result of community-based inequities and inaction. Decisions on how to prioritize individuals for vaccination should ideally consider all of the risks, medical and societal, associated with COVID-19. While vaccination shortages make these decisions difficult, it is impossible to ignore the urgent needs of an expensive and vulnerable population whose suffering is beyond comprehension for most of us. As states across the nation continue to expand their vaccination rollouts to populations outside of the elderly and healthcare providers, it is time to include the homeless and the frontline providers that help to provide life-saving services to them. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. Doris Eike, E-I-K-E, 86 years of age, from Radcliffe, passed away February 23rd. The Boki Funeral Home in Radcliffe is handling arrangements. Currently, no particular service arrangements have been set. Our next obituary, Todd Robert Throckmorton, age 48, of Huxley, died of natural causes on February 22 at his home in Huxley. Family services will be held Saturday, February 27th at 10 o'clock in the morning at Friedberg Lutheran Church in Huxley. That's F-J-E-I-D-B-E-R-G, Lutheran Church in Huxley. Burial will be in the Roland Cemetery at a later date. Todd was born August 11th, 1972, in Salt Lake City, Utah, to Wayne and Barbara Ursland Throckmorton. He lived in Huxley for the last 20 years, many of those years living and caring for his grandmother, Leah Ursland, so that she could remain living in her home. Todd enjoyed riding motorcycles and target shooting in his younger years. In his later years, he enjoyed reading Western novels, especially the White Indian series and Louis L'Amour. Todd also enjoyed cooking, spending time with his family and close friends, as well as playing computer games where he made friends from other states and even countries. He is survived by his mother, Barbara Ubin of Huxley, his grandmother, Leah Ursland of Huxley, two sisters, Terry and Craig Elrod of Ames, Iowa, and Mandy Damaris of Huxley, as well as a niece and several nephews. Todd was preceded in death by his father, Wayne Throckmorton, his grandfather, Robert Bob Ursland, grandparents, Wilson and Francis Throckmorton, and his stepfather, Wayne Ubin. Soderstrom Funeral Home is entrusted with arrangements. Now here's the real-life comic for today. A man and a woman are driving together in a car. Apparently they're in a relationship, as you will see when I read the captions. The woman says to the man, "Do you have a tissue? My nose is running." And the man says, "I've got one, but I already wiped my nose with it." And she says, "Whatever, just give it to me." And the man says, "Wow, it's a good relationship when you're not afraid to swap snot." And here's the Dilbert column for today. The boss man is sitting in a meeting with Dilbert and some of his other employees. And the boss says, "A trade publication ranked us dead last on their list of best places to work." He continues, "The review says employees say working there is like eating a barrel of dead squirrels." And the boss man finally says, "Could have been worse." And Dilbert says, "Only for the squirrels." Next, we have a story from the Arizona Republic newspaper. Arizona tribes receive vaccine doses at a high rate. After suffering heavy losses from COVID-19 in the past year, tribal communities across Arizona are on track or exceeding expectations with vaccinations against the virus, and some have begun offering shots to any community member over the age of 18. The Navajo Nation, which once had the highest coronavirus infection rate in the country, has now administered more than 101,000 doses of the vaccine, exceeding its goal to hit that number by the end of February. The confidence level in the vaccines is very high among our Navajo people, and that is evident by the long lines of people wanting to receive the vaccine that we see at each vaccination site. That according to Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez. The Gila River Indian community south of Phoenix has administered over 7,000 vaccine doses as of February 18th, according to Tribal Governor Stephen Rowe Lewis. Those are a combination of first and second doses. As a tribal leader, I am so pleased that the Biden administration has prioritized getting vaccines in regard to equity to communities that have been hit the hardest by the pandemic, Lewis said. Indian country has been disproportionately affected by COVID-19, especially the tribes here in Arizona, Lewis said. We've been playing defense this whole time. Having the ability to provide vaccines, at least as a tribal leader, is as the governor, for the Gila River Indian community, allows you to be on the offense against this virus, he said. Gila River received its vaccine through the Indian Health Service in December, and we've been getting a consistent supply, Lewis said. The community followed CDC guidelines on distribution by getting the elders and essential workers vaccinated first, but now, Lewis said, they are moving on to anybody older than 18 years of age. As a sovereign nation, we also prioritized our most vulnerable as well, Lewis said. One of the reasons our program works is that we were able to tailor the program to our community's needs. Lewis said his community is looking at vaccinating from a holistic point of view because they are unique. Tribal communities had the option of getting services through the IHS, or the state for vaccine distribution and administration. Lewis said they chose IHS because many tribes in Arizona, Lewis said they chose IHS as did many tribes in Arizona. He attributes part of the community's success for vaccine distribution to the partnership with that agency. They've done everything they can to make sure our tribal communities have the resources they need to vaccinate our people, Lewis added. On Thursday, the Indian Health Service announced on Twitter that it had surpassed its original goal of administering 400,000 COVID-19 vaccinations by the end of February. Even with vaccine efforts rolling out within indigenous communities across the country, indigenous people have experienced the highest death toll from COVID-19, according to a report from the APM Research Laboratory. Pacific Islanders, Latino, Black, and Indigenous Americans all have COVID-19 death rates of double or more than that of white and Asian Americans who experience the lowest age-adjusted rates, the report said. This means that one in 475 Indigenous Americans has died, or 210 deaths per 100,000, according to the report. The Navajo Nation, which was hard hit by the coronavirus from the beginning, has surpassed its vaccine goals and has seen its daily infection numbers decline. COVID-19 vaccine doses are going into the arms of our people at a very high rate here on the Navajo Nation, Nez said. Nez attributes the success of the vaccine rollout with the Navajo Nation to the coordination among the Navajo Area IHS, the Navajo Department of Health, tribal health organizations, and all of the healthcare workers. As of February 18, the Navajo Area IHS reported that 133,700 total vaccine doses have been received and 101,000 administered, which represents 76% of the total doses. So far, 23,700 individuals have received both a first and a second dose of the vaccine. I thank all of our Navajo people who are getting vaccinated to help protect themselves and others, Nez said. The Navajo Nation reported February 18th that the total number of positive COVID-19 cases was 29,300, with 1,127 deaths and 15,900 individuals who have recovered. Next, we have the coronavirus news briefing. Variants sweep across the nation in more states. Menacing coronavirus variants are sweeping across the nation even as new cases of the original virus are dropping quickly. The United States reported 1,932 variant cases through Tuesday night, up 49% from 1 week earlier. The variants appear to spread more easily, dodge some immunities and treatments, or both. They remain, however, a very small percentage of all cases. The B1351 variant, first detected in South Africa, was reported over the last week in Idaho, New Mexico, Nevada, New York, and Tennessee for the first time. On Sunday, South Carolina said it had two cases of that variant. On Tuesday, it reported 21 cases. The variant is a concern because experts warn it might spread more easily than the original virus and might reduce the effectiveness of some vaccines. The United States has more than 28 million confirmed cases and more than 503,000 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University data. The global totals, more than 112 million cases worldwide and 2.5 million deaths worldwide. More than 82 million vaccine doses have been distributed in the United States, and about 65 million doses have been administered. Next, from New York City, they will reopen their public schools in New York City for middle school students on Thursday, providing in-classroom learning for another 62,000 students whose parents opted out of remote education. About a quarter of the district's 1 million students will be back in schools, many for 5 days a week. Mayor de Blasio said Wednesday that he hopes to have an announcement on reopening high schools in the next few weeks. School reopening has prompted clashes between teachers and administrators over safety provisions. The mayor said the district is adhering to guidelines from the CDC, including universal and correct use of masks, physical distancing, hand washing with sanitizer everywhere, clean and well-ventilated spaces, and contact tracing when infections are discovered. Next, Dr. Anthony Fauci says a new eased guideline for people who have been vaccinated should be coming soon from the CDC. The White House's chief medical advisor told CNN the update will focus particularly on people in the same family who have been vaccinated. Easing the rules is nothing new. 2 weeks ago, the agency said fully vaccinated people did not have to follow quarantine rules. If I'm fully vaccinated and my daughter comes to the house and she's fully vaccinated, Fauci said, do we really need to have a stringent public health measure that we would if it was a stranger who was not vaccinated? The Department of Health, in our next item, the Department of Health and Human Services has drastically cut its capacity for immigrant children because of the pandemic. Nearly all of its 7,100 beds for the kids are full. Meanwhile, Border Patrol agents are apprehending an average of more than 200 children crossing the border without a parent every day. The Biden administration is working to expedite the release of children to their relatives in the United States. Health and Human Services on Wednesday authorized operators of long-term facilities to pay for some of the children's flights and transportation to the homes of their sponsors. An internal memo sent Wednesday and obtained by the AP authorizes facility operators to use government funding for transportation fees. Quote, in the event that a sponsor is not able to pay the fees associated with commercial airfare, and a child's physical release could be otherwise delayed, unquote. In our next item, CVS and Walgreens drugstores will start vaccinations in more states Thursday. CVS Health Corporation says it will add stores in 6 states, including Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania. Walgreens said it will expand into California, Oregon, and Virginia, among other states. Next, British scientists have found viruses similar to the strain that causes COVID-19 can survive on commonly worn fabrics for up to 3 days. The study by De Montfort University tested a model coronavirus on polyester, polycotton, and 100% cotton. The results suggested polyester posed the highest risk. Next in the series, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday acknowledged sharing vaccines with several countries that have given favors to Israel in the past. Israel faces international criticism for not doing more to share its vast stockpiles of vaccine with Palestinians in the territories it controls. Next in the series, more than 2,400 doses of vaccine in Tennessee's Shelby County, which includes Memphis, went to waste while local officials sat on tens of thousands of shots that they thought had already gone into arms. The state's top health official said, Health Commissioner Lisa Piercy said the problems were widespread and date back to February 3rd. Our next story comes to us from Kaiser Health News. States aim to chip away at Roe v. Wade. When Representative Lola Sheldon Galloway introduced a bill in the Montana House of Representatives 2 years ago that would have prohibited abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy, the Republican legislature knew it was unlikely to survive the veto pen of their Democratic governor. Sure enough, then-Governor Steve Bullock vetoed that bill and two other anti-abortion measures passed by the Republican-led legislature. In his veto message, Bullock wrote, quote, "For over 40 years, the United States Supreme Court has recognized that the United States Constitution prohibits a state from banning abortion," unquote. But now Bullock's gone. He's been replaced by Republican Governor Greg Gianforte, who has promised to sign any bill that puts new limits on abortion. And abortion rights advocates worry the court ruling that Bullock based his vetoes on, the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision by the Supreme Court, is on shaky ground. The Supreme Court tilted further right with last year's confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett, giving the High Court a makeup of 6 justices appointed by Republican presidents and 3 appointed by Democrats. That has emboldened lawmakers in Montana and other right-leaning states to introduce dozens of anti-abortion bills this year in the hope that the High Court will hear lawsuits against new state laws and side with the states. The goal is to chip away at Roe v. Wade. According to Kristen Ford, National Communications Director for NARAL Pro-Choice America, more than 60 bills have been introduced or passed in state legislatures so far this year to restrict abortion. Most are in conservative-leaning states like Montana, Kansas, and Wyoming. These legislators are willing to do whatever it takes to advance their extreme agenda of getting Roe v. Wade and pushing abortion care as far out of reach as possible, Ford said. With Roe in the crosshairs, the stakes for women, people who are pregnant, and families are higher than ever. Ford and other abortion right advocates say any one of those bills could be challenged and make its way to the Supreme Court. That's the apparent aim of conservative state lawmakers that are pushing bills. In Montana, legislators have introduced 6 anti-abortion measures so far this year, including Sheldon Galloway's proposed ban on abortions after 20 weeks. If this legislation made it all the way to the Supreme Court, that would be a good thing because we need to revisit Roe v. Wade, according to Sheldon Galloway. Eric Scheidler, executive director of the Pro-Life Action League based in Chicago, said the rash of bills exemplifies the changing methods of the anti-abortion movement. When his father founded the Pro-Life Action League in the 1970s, the organization's goal was simply to get Roe v. Wade decision overturned, either in the courts or in the state houses. But now anti-abortion groups are taking a piecemeal approach. He said it's more likely that the current Supreme Court will overturn Roe v. Wade incrementally rather than all at once. Will this court overturn Roe v. Wade? It's possible, Scheidler said, but I think we're more likely to see this court put more restrictions on abortion. I think 5 years from now, we will realize that Roe v. Wade was slowly overturned without it ever making a big headline. For anti-abortion groups, pushing legislation through at the state level may be their only option, since Democrats control Congress and the White House. President Joe Biden has said he wants to codify Roe v. Wade and appoint federal judges who will respect the precedent. Sheldon Galloway said her bill, dubbed the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, would protect unborn children who might feel pain during an abortion. Abortion advocates said that the bill is based on dubious science and that abortions at that point in pregnancy are rare and usually happen only for medical reasons. Similar bills are pending or have been introduced, I should say, in Florida, Hawaii, New Jersey, and Oregon. There are very few abortions that happen after 20 weeks, and when they do, they usually occur because of a significant medical issue, according to Allison James, chairperson of Montanans for Choice, an abortion rights group. These are usually wanted pregnancies, and so these unnecessary laws put women and families through the wringer. It will treat them like criminals. Such groups as Montanans for Choice have stepped up their efforts this year because they know that any abortion bill that passes the Montana legislature will be signed into law. Other bills working their way through the legislature would prohibit people from accessing abortion medications through the mail and require doctors to offer an ultrasound before terminating a pregnancy. Another would create a ballot initiative asking Montanans to decide whether fetuses that live through an abortion are people with legal rights. Similar legislation has been introduced in a dozen other states, according to the National Right to Life Committee. Nicole Smith, a fellow of the Society of Family Planning and a board member for Montanans for Choice, said, "It was highly likely that any abortion bills that become law would be challenged in court, making the states the first battleground in the new law's journey to the Supreme Court. We're seeing an onslaught of bills," Smith said, "and it will result in a legal battle." Our next story comes to us from Beijing, China. China's Mars craft enters parking orbit before landing its rover. China says its Tianwen-1 spacecraft has entered a temporary parking lot orbit around Mars in anticipation of landing a rover on the red planet in the coming months. The China National Space Administration said the spacecraft executed a maneuver to adjust its orbit early Wednesday morning, Beijing time, and it will remain in the new orbit for about the next 3 months before attempting to land. During that time, it will be mapping the surface of Mars and using its cameras and other sensors to collect further data, particularly about its prospective landing site. That follows the landing of the U.S. Perseverance rover last Thursday near an ancient river delta in Jezero Crater to search for signs of ancient microscopic life. A successful bid to land Tianwen-1 would make China only the second country after the United States to place a spacecraft on Mars. China's solar-powered vehicle, about the size of a golf cart, will collect data on underground water and look for evidence that the planet may have once harbored microscopic life. Tianwen, the title of an ancient poem, means quest for heavenly truth. Landing a spacecraft on Mars is notoriously tricky. About a dozen orbiters missed the mark in 2011. A Mars-bound Chinese orbiter that was part of a Russian mission did not make it out of Earth orbit. China's attempt will involve a parachute, rocket firings, and airbags. Its proposed landing site is a vast rock-strewn plain called Utopia Planitia, where the U.S. Viking 2 lander touched down in 1976. Tianwen-1's arrival at Mars on February 10th was preceded by that of an orbiter from the United Arab Emirates. All three of the latest missions were launched in July to take advantage of the close alignment between Earth and Mars that happens only once every 2 years. Tianwen-1 represents the most ambitious mission yet for China's secretive military link space program that first put an astronaut in orbit around the Earth in 2003 and last year brought moon rocks back to the Earth for the first time since the 1970s. China was also the first country to land a spacecraft on the little explored far side of the moon in 2019. China is also building a permanent space station and planning a crewed lunar mission, as well as a possible permanent research base on the moon. And that is all that we have time for with today's Ames Tribune. Your reader today has been Dave Sauerman. Thank you for listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped.